So I'm going to talk about analytic covariance of power spectrum multipoles for galaxy surveys. That's going to be the main focus of my talk. But towards the end, I'll also talk about neutral hydrogen maps for upcoming surveys like CHIME, which I thought people in the audience might be interested in. So this is work done with Roman Skocimaro and Misha Ivano at NYU. And let me get started. Okay. So before I talk about the main focus of my talk, just to give an overview of some other research that I do, I also work on observations of dwarf galaxies to constrain alternatives to cold dark matter. So I've worked on constraining ultralight dark photon dark matter or Mealy charge dark matter with Professor Glenn S. Farrar. If people are interested, we can talk later. But let me directly go into the main topic of my talk. So this is going to be the galaxy power spectrum covariance. So just to give a background of why should we care about galaxy power spectrum covariance, or where does it enter into the pipeline for calculating the parameter constraints. I've shown this brief slide. So we observe like positions of galaxies on the sky and their redshifts. And from this 3D catalog, what we do is we try to calculate summary statistics. The most popular summary statistic that we use is called the power spectrum. And so you calculate these black dots from the galaxies that you observe in your survey. And then you compare these dots to your theory predictions, which is shown in blue. So one important thing, ingredient in this pipeline is the covariance to do a likelihood analysis for comparing your cosmological parameters. So here I've shown the likelihood where the covariance enters as I've shown here in the chi-squares. And so to calculate like all the constraints on these cosmological parameters theta, you need a robust estimate of covariance. And so now when galaxy surveys in the past have calculated covariance, they have used mock catalogs to do it. So in this traditional process, we need to simulate thousands of mock surveys. So what we are intending here is to capture the cosmic variance effect, where we don't know what the precise initial conditions were, which created this galaxy field that we observed. So there is a variation in the power spectrum because of that. And to capture that.
May I ask you something? So on the previous slide, so you have this probability, which assumes Gaussian distribution as it looks, yeah? So yes. How good is it? And what if the error bars are not Gaussian?
So for modes that we are interested in a redshift analysis, we have the central limit theorem, which makes the likelihood Gaussian. And so this is for small scale modes, typically of the size that we are interested in for a redshift space analysis. But then if you want to probe, say, primordial non-Gaussianity, then you have to question this assumption and try to use some other likelihoods. But
mm-hmm. Well, you say short scale modes, so what are them in terms of megaparsecs?
So in terms of like anything beyond say k 0.05, you are fine with this approximation. So
okay.
Around like 0.01, maybe you have to start worrying about this Gaussian likelihood.
I see. Okay. But these are deeply nonlinear already. 0.05, that's quite nonlinear regime, yeah? So,
no. Sorry, no, 0.05 is, fairly linear.
Okay, yeah, on the borderline. Well, at phi z, yeah, probably work at... So what redshifts you consider?
So I'm going to talk about BOSS. So 0.2 to 0.7.
Okay, yeah. So on the borderline. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. But yeah, okay. Anyway, I mean, we need the covariance matrix for calculating these constraints from summary statistics. So yeah, I've shown the process that is used in previous surveys. So what we do is you simulate thousands of dark matter boxes, and these are like large boxes because you need to fit your survey volume inside these boxes. So these are order gigaparsec cube. And we cannot even like make thousands of gigaparsec cube n-body simulations. So what we do is we use approximate dark matter simulation to make these boxes. And then what we do is we use some fitting techniques to populate halos onto these approximate simulations. Then we populate galaxies onto these halos, and we cut a volume similar to the survey volume from all these boxes. And when we have these catalogs, we then calculate the summary statistics for each of these catalog. And so we have thousands of these power spectra, and then we can combine this using a relation that I've shown to calculate the covariance matrix. So I'm calculating these error bars are a combination of all these power spectra calculated through this process. And so this has been the traditional process that has been used by past surveys like BOSS or EBOSS. But then as survey volume increases, your mock catalogs, they become tougher to simulate because you have to make large boxes to fit your survey volume in. And the second drawback with this mock catalog approach is that your dependence variance matrix on cosmology or bias parameters is computationally prohibitive. So here is the exact form of like the likelihood that I've shown. But in surveys, what we do is we approximate the covariance matrix at a particular value of the cosmology and bias parameters, so theta naught. Because when we do this process, we can do this process for a single set of cosmology and bias parameters. If we change those, we have to do this process again, and it's computationally prohibitive. So we ignore the dependence of cosmology and bias on the covariance using these mock catalog method. And the last drawback to this traditional approach is that the mocks, they suffer from sampling noise. So you have to simulate a large number of mocks to keep this sampling noise down. And if you have a finite number of mocks, you need to artificially inflate your error bars on your parameters. So actually, before I discuss the analytic calculation, I thought I should show the results to see what agreement we get with these state-of-the-art mock simulations for the covariance. And then I can discuss about some ways in which we get lucky in our analytic calculation, and also some other ways where we deal with some non-trivial effects related to survey in our analytic calculation. But let me first just compare the results that we got with the mocks that were used for the SDSS BOSS parameter estimation. So here I've shown diagonals in three cases for the power spectrum. So this is the monopole, the angle average power spectrum over the sky. This is the quadrupole and the hexadecapole. And you can see that the analytic calculation agrees quite well with these mock simulations. And not only does it agree to like linear scales or quasi-linear scales, it agrees all the way down to non-linear scales, which is like k equal to 0.6. So I'll come back to this point of why an analytic calculation, which you would naively think that would dominate or would be accurate at large scales, is also being accurate at very small scales. I'll discuss this point later.
Where does it start deviating?
So that's a good question. Actually, our initial motivation was to go to k equal to 0.3 because for BOSS, they only did their analysis to 0.15. to avoid the nonlinear scales. So then we actually tried to push it further to 0.6, and we did not find any discrepancy. So we didn't try to push even beyond that, because these scales are beyond a perturbative calculation. Like you would not be able to model your power spectrum down to these scales anymore.
Yeah.
So
okay.
You wouldn't.
So it's an unexpected surprise here. Yeah, it's doing that well.
This is like a proof of principle that, I mean, for covariance, I think you are fine even down to nonlinear scales. So I'll come back to this point. So this is an important point that we realize. There's a caveat in the calculation which makes this agreement so well. And
so, sorry, can I ask a question? So you want to use this for Boss galaxy power spectrum?
Yes.
Okay, so then... But your simulations, they don't have galaxies, they're dark matter, right? So what are we doing about that?
I mean, in the mocks, they actually try to fit try to populate galaxies onto these dark matter simulations using approximate methods. So they calibrate these methods to some semi-analytic models or some hydrodynamic simulations, and then you can make these galaxy mocks. This is how traditionally people make these mocks. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So let me show like some other results very briefly. So in the last slide, I was just showing the diagonals. Here, the point of this slide is to show that we not only agree for the diagonal elements, we also agree for the off-diagonal elements. Which you can see, I mean, you can compare the dashed lines with the solid lines. So I have compared two rows of the covariance in this figure. Let me show one more case, which I didn't show in the last two plots. This is the cross covariance. So for a redshift space analysis, we use the monopole and quadrupole for our analysis, because you can break important degeneracies in your parameter space when you use both these components. So what we have to also model the cross covariance, and I've shown the analytic method to these mock simulations for the cross covariance, and you can immediately see on the right side that these mock simulations that were used in BOSS, they have a very large sampling noise, because you used 2000 simulations and they are not enough to bring down the sampling noise. And one very good thing about the analytic method is you don't have this sampling noise. And I'll again get back to this point.
Just to clarify for me, Jay, just remind me, for your dark matter simulations, were there halos being found or not? I forgot.
If you do n-body simulations for mocks, then you have to use halo finders to find halos, and then you populate these halos using galaxies using halo occupation distribution or some methods. But then when people do these approximate n-body simulations, they also have to fit the halos approximately. So they are doing like two LPT, and then they are approximating halos using spherical collapse.
But in this comparison you're showing, this was using actual halos, is that right?
So this is just comparing, you're talking about the mock data or the analytic?
This comparison on this slide that you're showing, were these mocks generated by populating halos or by populating just like dark matter sims with galaxies?
So these were generated by populating dark matter sims with galaxies. They did populate halos as like a intermediary step, but it's not as robust as n-body simulations. For n-body simulations, you need a long time to run. These techniques that they use to make these approximate simulations, they involve like methods like two LPT on large scales and spherical collapse on small scales.
Okay, but things like COLA, for example, were not used.
Yes, that's one good example of these, one of the techniques, yes.
Okay, thanks.
So yeah, there is a lot of like, there are a lot of people interested in these approximate techniques, and covariance has been one major motivation for these approximate techniques, because to bring down the sampling noise, you have to simulate large number of mocks.
So here you use your own mocks, you made your own mocks, or these are mocks used by BOSS?
So these are mocks used by BOSS.
I see.
Sorry, do you think that disagreement at very large K is because the mocks are approximate, or do you think this is, you can reproduce this also for the full M-body simulations?
I'll get back to this point of why we agree at a very large K or very small scales. So this, I'll get back to this point.
Okay.
Okay. So the previous results were like in our first paper, where we are comparing these elements of covariance matrix to elements of your analytic calculation matrix. But some of the like people pointed out that you can compare like two matrices can have very similar elements, but then when you use these matrices in your parameter estimation calculation, you use the inverse of the matrix, and two matrices which are very similar can have very different inverses, because inverse of the matrix depends on the eigenvalue structure. For some matrices, you can change elements by a slight amount, and you can change the eigenvalue structure like drastically. So the next step that we did was to check this actually in a full BOSS analysis using the full shape power spectrum data. So we use the pipeline of that Misha has worked on with the group at IAS. So this is the full shape pipeline. And in this figure, I'm showing a comparison of the constraints that we get using these approximate mocks versus the analytic method in blue and gray. And you can see that the blue and gray are very similar to each other, and they agree pretty well. The analytic calculation results agree pretty well with these mock simulation. So yeah, this was for the full BOSS sample. Let me into a particular case study, which is for a particular sample in the BOSS data, which is this North Galactic Cap high redshift sample. So here again, I'm showing the same curves where you have these mocks from BOSS simulation in gray, and for the analytic covariance, I'm now doing like two versions. So this is related to the effect that I was talking about earlier, that in these mocks, you have only simulated your covariance matrix, cosmology and a bias parameter set. And you cannot vary these cosmology and bias parameters because it is computationally prohibited. So we went on to check whether when you use different like parameters for your covariance matrix, do you obtain same constraints? So this is an important check that is actually also performed already for the CMB analysis, where you see whether your parameter constraints are robust with changing your covariance matrix. But for BOSS, this was computationally prohibitive. But in using the analytic method, we did this check and we found that the BOSS constraints are indeed robust. So we checked our covariance for two cases. The one is the cosmology and bias used in these patchy mocks versus the best fit cosmology that we get as an output from our MCMC chain. So we can re-simulate the covariance matrix very easily. And you can see the results are robust. And so there is one more thing which we noticed was that there are some small shifts in some parameters. These are around like 0.2 sigma. And we checked that these shifts are because of sampling noise, which I will like explain in more detail in the next slide. So this is regarding that you are using 2000 mocks, so for your covariance matrix analysis, and because of the finite number, you have some noise in your matrix. So actually, we tried to see what is the noise in the matrix itself because of using these 2000 mocks. And I'm showing in this figure the error in the elements of this matrix when you use the when you use like 2000 mocks. And you have error on the off-diagonal elements, but for the diagonals, you are you don't have much error. And so we try to, the next step was trying to see how this noise in your matrix affects your parameter constraints. So we did like a very simple test. What you can do, you can just take a covariance matrix and then sample power spectra from it. So you you can sample like 2000 power spectra from your matrix and then make a sample, artificial sample covariance, and see whether that changes any of your parameter constraints. So here I have shown in the colored are three artificial sampled versions of your covariance. So if your 2000 mocks are enough and covariance matrix is converged, you should not expect to see any change in your parameter constraints when you do this test. But then you can see that there are some spurious shifts in your parameter constraints. They are a bit small, like 0.3 sigma. But then there are some variations in your constraints when you use these mock simulations. And other than shifts, there are also some cases we saw that you have some spurious inflation or deflation in your parameter error bars. So I've shown one case where we saw that there was like an 18% like deflation in parameter constraints. And this could be important because when you are comparing like tensions in two data sets, spuriously deflating your error bars, you might have a larger tension than you would naively expect. And these results have been well studied in the literature. So I have given two references if people want to refer to. So there is, even after using these 2000 mocks, there are some effects due to sampling noise. And this is one another advanced analytic method at this point is you don't have these sampling in your parameter analysis. So, okay. Then let me talk about why did people use these approximate simulations to calculate the covariance matrix, or what were the challenges that we had to face do this calculation. So the first challenge is that the survey window is highly non-trivial. So there are two components to the spectroscopic survey like BOS. So first of all, there is a radial selection function. You have galaxies equally at all redshifts. And the next part is the angular part. You don't, I mean, there are some holes in the sky where you don't observe your galaxies. And all of this, a combination of this is the is called like the survey window. I've shown here W of X. So the overdensities that you measure from your survey are a product of your true overdensity times this survey window. And so this enters your covariance calculation, because in your covariance, you are calculating bar on the power. So you're calculating the error of the two-point function. So it becomes like a four-point function. So this four-point function has basically four overdensity terms. Each of this is coupled to this. Each of this term is like a convolution of your window and the true overdensity. So so in Fourier space, that's why you have this convolutional integrals. And you can see that this integral is like an 18-dimensional integral with four of these non-trivial window functions. So it's a bit like hard to calculate analytically directly. But what we realized was that you can use some approximations to do this calculation, and these approximations like drastically simplify your full calculation. And the approximation that we found works well, that you can separate your clustering terms, like your power spectrum terms, from these non-trivial window terms. So here I'm assuming that the power spectrum does not change it's over the bins that are used in your survey for analysis. So this is a good assumption because you do your bins very finely in your survey, and the power spectrum does not vary significantly over the bins. But this highlights actually one important point about this analytic calculation, that all of your dependence on these cosmology and bias parameters, these are all decoupled. And so if you tell me to calculate my covariance matrix at a different cosmology or bias, all I have to do is just change the best fit power spectrum model. And these the term in the curly bracket, that only needs to be calculated once the entire analysis. So, and if people are familiar with the galaxy and random catalogs, you can calculate this term using fast Fourier transforms of your survey random catalog, which capture your survey geometry. And so this was like one way where we could tackle this problem of this non-trivial window and its effect on covariance. So now let me bring on the second challenge, which is that you would naively expect the perturbation theory calculations to work in the linear regime. And we found that like our techniques were working even in very non-linear scales. And so I'll talk about why this is the case. So this is also brings me back to the question that was asked earlier. So I've shown just naively that if you ignore any kind of non-linearities in your calculation for the quadrupole power spectrum, you already find huge discrepancies even at scales like k equal to 0.2. But then if you ignore non-linearities like fingers of God and loops, we still have a very, very good agreement for the covariance even up to non-linear scales. And so I'll discuss why. And the reason is because of the number densities in the survey, which is also referred to as short noise. So just to give overview of this effect, when you have your survey which has a high number density, what you are doing is what we see on the sky is this histogram. We don't see underlying matter fields or galaxy fields in the survey. We see the galaxies which populate these matter fields or trace these matter fields. So for a high number density survey, you would have this case as shown in the top panel. But then I think the realistic surveys are of the type as I've shown in the bottom panel, where your number density is low, that your Poisson fluctuations are the ones which dominate your error bars on small scales. And the one interesting thing about these fluctuations is that they can be well modeled analytically because these are of the of Poisson type, and you know how to model Poisson fluctuations analytically. So just to show
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So the mocks assume Poisson fluctuations, right, or not?
Yes, the approximate mocks do, yes.
So then, of course, then your analytic model also assumes Poisson fluctuations, so those two match. But in the real world, you may not actually have Poisson fluctuations because there could be correlations between, I don't know, if you have pairs of galaxies and things of that on a small scale. So, I mean, what would you say to that?
Yes, so this is a good point, actually. So we were not very confident that we would, replicate the short noise because, as you point out, I mean, in reality, there are these halo exclusion effects which actually make your noise non-Poissonian. But then what we saw was that these approximate mock catalogs that people have been using, those are just replicating this Poisson noise. And it is very hard for these catalogs to do a realistic job of modeling the noise because these don't simulate like halos. And these noise because comes because like your halos might be like too close to each other. So analytic theory, I mean, the terms we have included right now, we haven't included the non-Poissonian terms, but the analytic calculation actually, you can include these non-Poissonian terms and model the covariance even better than what these mocks can do. So that's actually a plus point for the analytic calculation. You can only include some terms and you will be able to model these non-Poissonian statistics.
Sounds good, thanks.
Yeah. So here I've shown how much the short noise say dominates your covariance at what scales. So I've shown in this figure the monopole cross monopole and quadrupole cross quadrupole covariance, the diagonal elements, which are the most important for your parameter analysis. And so I've shown the short noise in these dashed lines and the black represents the total ones. And so as you can see at even beyond like k equal to 0.1, the covariance starts to get dominated by these short noise components. And as you go to high k, this domination becomes like even stronger. And so in our analytic calculation, we don't include these high order loops, but the high order loops at large scales, they're contributing to these solid lines, the orange line in particular. But then you can see that the short noise is like a lot higher than these orange lines that it would not, that is why these non-linearities do not affect the final answer for the covariance. And this is like one of the things where I think we got lucky in doing this analytic calculation because you can just predict this high short noise and you can get very accurate results. And okay, so then this brings me to this question that I've shown all the results till now for the Boss survey. So we use the number density exactly what was in the Boss survey. And so how would this method work at for upcoming surveys like DESI or Euclid? So I've shown like a plot to answer this. So in this plot on the y-axis is basically the signal to noise or your power spectrum divided by short noise. So for various surveys. So for Boss, the results are shown in red. And actually, you can see that Euclid, for the most part, it has like similar number densities as Boss, and you expect it also to be short noise dominated for the covariance at a small scale. And for DESI, there is most of the survey is in this regime, but then there is this BGS sample, which has a very high number density. So you have, for this survey, you see that the level of short noise is like a factor of few lower than Boss. But then, like as I showed in my previous slide, here you have like a factor of 20 or higher level of short noise compared to these non-linearities, even at like very non-linear scales. And so even for the BGS sample, I think this analytic method would work for the covariance. And that is why we think that you can use these methods for the upcoming surveys. So these are computationally much less expensive and don't have sampling noise.
So just understand, so your full model is just to take three-level covariance and put short noise on it, is it?
For the Gaussian case, we are using the full one loop model, because it is very trivial for us to use. This is already modeled in the calculation. We just take this model and we can input it in our Gaussian case.
I see.
But then there is this non-Gaussian part where you have the four-point function. This we have only done till tree level. But then this is a much less important part and has like very less contribution to the final parameter constraints. That's what we realized. So that is why we are okay. So in the end, just to summarize, I mean, we think that the k up to which you can model your power spectrum, you will be very fine using analytic covariance.
With the Gaussian part, just using the Gaussian contribution.
And for the non-Gaussian, I mean, there is this additional help because of this short noise.
Right.
So I mean, the loop levels, the loop effects here would be much less dominant because of there being this high shortness. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So now, I mean, let me like project a bit for say like upcoming surveys, and if you want to go beyond say like a 2-point analysis. So let me do like a back of envelope estimate of like, can we keep using mock catalogs if we want to go beyond a 2-point analysis? So the number of mock simulations right now for the BOSS survey have been like 2000 that they have created. And this criteria for having a low sampling noise in your analysis is that the size of your data vector has to be smaller than the number of mocks, because you're estimating the error bar on this using your number of mocks. So, okay, for the K bins that are used in a power spectrum analysis. So for BOSS, they used around 100 K bins. And this is okay. I mean, so I've shown in the previous slides that there were some constraints, but there were some changes in the constraints, but only at like level of like 0.2, 0.3 sigma. So you might get by. It won't be ideal, but you might get by with the for the power spectrum analysis using these mocks. But then if you want to go to higher point functions like bispectrum, to do a robust analysis, you need like around 6,000 mocks for the BOSS survey. But you can immediately see that the covariance becomes like a bottleneck factor if you use the mock simulation. So this is actually was also a bottleneck for the bispectrum analysis that was done for BOSS, where they had to make their triangles for the K bins that they used for making these triangles was high, because they had to cut down on the number of triangles that they can use in order to get an estimate of the covariance from mocks. So this would be the analytic approach, I think, would be very helpful for these higher order statistics if we get to use them. And one more point where these analytic approaches would help is that when for analysis which are like combinations of individual analysis, you can get a high dimensionality of your covariance matrix, and then approximating it from mocks is difficult because again you get a sampling noise. So in the future we would have say like constraints coming from 3D positions of galaxies, from weak lensing, from cluster counts, from intensity mapping. And so if we want to do a joint analysis of these things, the size of our data vector is going to be like quite large, and we need some other ways than mock simulations to estimate the covariance. So I think the analytic method would be useful as we like project in the future for the upcoming surveys. Okay, so I think I'm done with the first part of my talk. So if people have questions, I can answer them now before jumping into this neutral hydrogen and its relation to these surveys like CHIME. That's the second part of my talk. Okay. Okay, so let me then just change gears a bit and talk about some of the other work that I did with some people at CCA. So Paco Villescusa-Navarro, who's now at Princeton, Shirley, who's at CCA, and Lawrence, who's in Montreal. So the focus of the work was trying to generate large volume neutral hydrogen simulations just by using dark matter simulation. And then we employ techniques like machine learning and symbolic regression that I will get to. So let me give like an overview of why is this important to make these large volume neutral hydrogen simulations. So we are now, I mean, there are a lot of upcoming surveys where you will have neutral hydrogen from large volumes of the universe, like CHIME, HYRAX. You'll observe like 100 gigaparsec cube of the universe. And to compare these observations to simulations, we need like very large volume simulations. And these simulations are useful to test the effect of observational systematics, to check whether your perturbation theory model that you are using to what scales is it accurate for. And also, if you want to do a nonlinear analysis, these are helpful for the a simulation which is of the same volume as the survey will be helpful for doing this simulation-based inference kind of analysis. So right now, for neutral hydrogen, the most accurate simulation that we have are these hydrodynamic simulations like elasticity and G, for example. But the problem of these simulations is that they are very expensive. So you need say like 10 million CPU hours for a very, very small volume of this simulation, because you have like a lot of baryonic effects that you have to simulate. And so what we need is we need a quick way to make these neutral hydrogen, large volume neutral hydrogen maps from dark matter boxes. And the traditional method that we do use for this transformation basically is called Hilo occupation distribution. So what we do is basically we first simulate large volume dark matter map, and we know how to do dark matter simulations quickly because we have worked on it for more than three decades now. And these are gravity only simulations, so you don't have to simulate like complex star formation. And so what we do is we simulate a large volume, find the halos inside these dark matter boxes, and then what we do is we calibrate a simple relation from a hydrodynamic simulation like elasticity and G. You take the halos in the elasticity and G simulation, and you can make a simple relation for the halo mass as compared to the neutral hydrogen mass. And so this is the green line where I fitted like a power law with a cutoff for this case. And so how you make these neutral hydrogen maps is you pick a dark matter halo, you know its mass, you can read off its neutral hydrogen mass from this relation, and then you can just fill in neutral hydrogen into this halo. And there is this long-standing and widely used assumption which goes into this analysis, is that your neutral hydrogen mass of a halo is only dependent on the halo mass, or is only a function of the halo mass. What I'm neglecting here is I'm neglecting the assembly history of the halo. I'm neglecting that this halo is in a different environment as compared to some similar mass halo in a different like place in the simulation. And the intuition behind this analysis is that baryons follow dark matter. So if you have a halo which has a lot of dark matter, you expect like a monotonic relation between the baryonic mass and the dark matter mass. And this is how these techniques, like, this approximation is widely used in these techniques. So let me talk about like an alternative technique that you can use to do this same analysis. So you can use a neural network, which you can train to produce a neutral hydrogen map from a dark matter only simulation. So I can give it like multiple cubes from Elastis TNG and multiple outputs, and then it can learn to basically generate this from this. And so basically what the neural network is doing is just finding out a function where the neutral hydrogen mass of a particular point is a function of the dark matter mass at that point and the dark matter in the neighborhood voxels. So this is like a simple way to intuitively understand what the network is learning. And you can see the results that we get from this machine learning model that we use. So for the maps, I've shown in the case below. And for the clustering statistics, you can see that the neural network is actually outperforming the traditional method, which I described in the previous slide, by a large amount. So around like say 20% in for the power spectrum, and also for other statistics like the bias spectrum. And so, I mean, we found this in our previous project that this network performed better. But then our motivation was to analyze, like if there is a particular feature that these neural networks are using in their prediction, which these traditional halo models we are ignoring. And if we can identify this, we can use these insights to augment our traditional halo models. So,
wait, Jay, can I ask, so for this comparison you're showing, was the network trained on the same illustrious TNG data set that you're comparing with?
Yes. So we divided the full volume into a training set and a test set. And I'm showing these results for the test set. So it has been trained on a different volume, and then we used it to predict a volume that it hadn't seen. But this is all trained from one single Elastis TNG simulation.
Right. And so if you try to apply this network, for some other simulation that had some other like galaxy formation parameters, how would that do in comparison to these HOD models?
Yes. So I mean, actually in the second half of this, I'll talk about this. Yeah. So this is actually one motivation that Neil pointed out was also a very good point about neural networks, that you can, you cannot use them beyond a particular simulation with a particular hyperparameters. So if you change the baryonic feedback, the neural network would not be able to replicate your results. Or if you change the resolution of your input simulation, the neural network would not be able to produce like the final answer, which is accurate. So we try to see whether you can learn something interesting from these neural networks. And we can augment our traditional models using these networks. And basically what we wanted to do was plagiarize the UNet because it was performing better than our models. So this actually brings me to a question where, this is actually also related to this question whether can we understand how the baryons are connected to the dark matter? Because right now we are using this assumption that the baryonic mass of a halo is only related to its dark matter mass. And are there like other parameters which can be useful? And this therefore relates to like also like galaxy formation physics, which I'll get to. But also one more motivation for doing this analysis is that for galaxy data, actually there is a discrepancy at small scales when you compare lensing versus the prediction that you get from these halo models. And so we wanted to see if we can understand some useful insights from these networks. So one easy thing you can do to see what the information the neural network is using is to calculate the saliency map. So on the top, I've shown an example where the network is basically trained to identify like a dog versus a cat in an image. And you can see these are the pixels in the input image which this network is looking at. And So we did the same thing for our case, where we put a small halo in an overdense and an anisotropic environment. And like the job of the network was to predict neutral hydrogen inside this halo. And you can see that the network is not only using this local information, which is this assumption that we make in this halo model, that the neutral hydrogen in this halo is only dependent on the dark matter mass of the halo. But it is also using like some kind of information in the environment. And what we were seeing was that it actually underpredicts the amount of neutral hydrogen once this halo is in this non-trivial environment. If I place this halo in a blank environment, it predicts more neutral hydrogen than it does for this case that I'm showing. And so actually the neural networks, without taking a course in galaxy formation, we saw that they had learned to model ram pressure stripping just by observing data from elasticity NG simulation. So here is a picture that I've shown. This is actually a Hubble image, and then you have a Chandra image superposed onto it, where you can see this small galaxy is having trouble holding onto its gas because the environment around this in this cluster is ionized, and that exerts like a pressure on the gas of this galaxy. And so a small galaxy in a very overdense environment would lose neutral hydrogen mass. And this is what the network was predicting. So that we wanted to use this information, let's say, to devise a better halo model. And there is this question is a bit complex because there are a lot of parameters for the halo that you can use. And our goal basically here is to find the neutral hydrogen mass of a halo as some function of the halo mass, but also include some of these parameters. And the complexity here is that multiple parameters are related to each other. So for example, the concentration of the halo is related to assembly history, and this is also related to the environment of the halo. And so actually, I wanted to kind of highlight that there is this technique called symbolic regression, which you can use to extract symbolic equations directly from data. And so this is like, I think this is very useful for physics because you can, like once you have extracted these equations, you can get a lot of like intuitive understanding of this underlying process directly from the data. And so actually I'm showing the final results that we got using this symbolic regression. So in this plot, again, I'm showing the truth, which is the elasticity NG simulation. And
can I ask you a question? So what's the difference between symbolic regression and just regression?
For normal regression, you assume a functional form when you fit to a data set. So I'm assuming halo mass and then say exponential of concentration, and then you fit that functional form to some data set. But then in this case, like assembly bias, which people call in colloquial literature, you have a lot of parameters and you don't know what the functional form is to even like start fitting to your data set. So the symbolic regressor finds out a functional form and also then fits it. So it does both things for you.
But then you just found the linear result, didn't you?
So our motivation, so there are still non-trivialities. So our motivation was to find very simple equations which can explain the results from elasticity NG. But then the non-trivial thing about this is that, so here it is a combination of two parameters, the overdensity and the anisotropy. And in a naive way, you don't know what parameters to combine to produce your final equation.
So
what sets of parameters are going to give you the best trend, you don't know that beforehand. So this is one way it is helpful is in that. And so let me show the results. The elasticity is basically the truth. The HOD is the green line, which is a bit discrepant. And black is the result from this another machine learning model called Random Forest. But then the main point of this slide is the blue line, which is this simple like symbolic expressions which we can use to augment your Halo occupation distribution models. And you can see that they are performing quite well compared to the traditional model. So this brings me back to the question that Neil asked. Now, I mean, once we have like boiled down our understanding to these simple equations, then you can just use these equations on other n-body simulations with a different resolution to get these accurate neutral hydrogen maps. So these are useful in that sense. You don't have to train your machine learning models again. And then there are a lot of actually physical insights that we got from these equations. So I think I'm running out of time, but if I have like 2 more minutes, I can go into some physical insights, but otherwise I can
stop. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. So
Before you go.
So these parameters that you found here from this symbolic regression for a different HOD, they may be different, right? Or from for different physics. Okay, let's put it more general.
Yes. So the next thing we are going to do is actually people at CCA, they have now simulated around like 2000 hydrodynamic simulations with like different sets of baryonic feedback. So One interesting thing to do is check whether how these equations change with the baryonic physics. So in my next slide, I will talk about that. I think these relations are very general. And there are some behaviors that I would expect even when you change baryonic feedback. In the last 2 minutes, let me like talk about the physical insights that you can get and why this neutral hydrogen is like a very interesting tracer of dark matter. So here I've shown basically the neutral hydrogen mass of the halo, and on the x-axis is the overdensity. So here on the left is the underdense environment, on the right is an overdense environment. And so if you ignore, so this is the data from Illustris 3NG, these solid lines. And what you expect from these HOD models is that you get, you do not expect your neutral hydrogen to vary with environment. You only expect it to vary with halo mass. So you get like a flat line if you assume HOD. And I've shown this for now multiple halo masses to just show the difference with halo mass. And so in this plot, you can see at for low halos, low mass halos, there is a clear trend where you are increasing as you make your environment overdense. But then after you go to a certain point, after that you start decreasing beyond a particular threshold. And so actually, you can understand this based on this. I've made this cartoons basically. So what is happening for the trend where you are going down? Another way to put this question is that why are not baryons just following dark matter? Because if baryons just follow dark matter, you would get this line at one all the time. But then what happens in these small halos is that once you are in a very overdense environment, like beyond a certain point, you're basically very close to a big cluster. And in a cluster, you have the medium is ionized. And there is this effect called ram pressure stripping, which like strips your gas out of a small halo, which I had shown in this previous slide. And so that's why you get this downturn after a particular environmental overdensity. And this is the other part. So you also have this uptrend, which you need to explain. So the uptrend is because as you are getting more overdense, you accumulate your mass through mergers. And so this is a bit non-trivial, but for neutral hydrogen, you need to have very compact like places where you form these neutral hydrogen. If you have a neutral hydrogen which is like scattered in a big volume, the surrounding radiation would just like ionize this and you would not have any neutral hydrogen. So for halos which are in a dense environment, they have gone through more mergers, and so the sub-halo content in them basically has more, has a compact neutral hydrogen content to them. And so you need this to shield yourself from these surrounding radiation. And that's why you have this uptrend. So this was just like two cartoons that I drew to kind of explain this effect. So there is this important effect of environment, which we saw. I mean, this could be interesting because either that the data from next generation galaxy surveys might be you might be able to constrain these environmental effects or the feedback parameters in your hydrodynamic simulations, because you see a big effect in your clustering statistics because of this dirty astrophysical effects, you would say. So, and then other thing is basically that the neutral hydrogen mass is not just a function of halo mass, but it is also a function of the environment. So this can be, I mean, some interesting way to maybe probe neutral hydrogen. But then we are exploring this. So this is a work in progress. But I think, let me just conclude. The first part of my talk was about analytic covariance, and it is an excellent alternative to mock simulations. So you have very good agreement with nonlinear, up to nonlinear scales with these mock simulations. There is a lot of computational speed up, and there are no effects of sampling noise. And then in the second part, I talked about using these technique called symbolic regression to model this non-trivial phenomena of assembly bias from these hydrodynamic simulations. And one other thing which I didn't mention earlier was that we can also, this can help us to guide detection of assembly bias in survey data, because if you have a neural network, it has like 10 million parameters, and you can't do a Bayesian analysis with like 10 million parameters. So you once you have boiled down your assembly bias to like two or three parameters, then you can try to constrain it using this data from surveys, and the symbolic regression helps you do that. So I guess that's where I would end. Thanks.
All right, awesome. Okay, thanks, Jay. So let's all give him a round of applause. Okay, any further questions for the speaker? I mean, we are a bit over time, but we can still take like one or two questions if people have anything further. Okay, all right. I'm not seeing any raised hands. So given the time, we can stop here. Okay, great. So thanks again, Jay, for a very interesting talk.